Okay, it looks like we are now ready to go on to Barbara Jordan versus Panorama Orthopedics. May I have any other appearances, please? First from Ms. Jordan. All right, thank you very much. And for Panorama Orthopedics, please.
Alan Lexman, representing Panorama Orthopedics and Spine Center.
All right, thank you. This case is set for 1 hour. That means, Mr. Boyle, that you have half an hour to present your argument, as do you, Ms. Rapsen, of course. Mr. Boyle, if you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal, you need to keep track of your own time, please. Whenever you're ready, sir, you may go ahead.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. If not, if Panorama is not a landowner, then who is? The Premises Liability Act rejected traditional labels and instead imposed a test that includes people that hold actual possession of property, their agents, and then it includes circumstances that exist on the property, includes activities on the property, and it's not just a possession and control test. It's more than that. That Panorama dominated the Panorama Medical Campus. They set up this campus to include them in the building and three other tenants who service their patients. They have an imaging center, a physical therapy center, and a surgical center, which is mostly owned by the Panorama surgeons. But those other three parts are interchangeable parts. But the physical therapist moves out, a new physical therapist will come in. They won't bring in, you know, a lawyer or some other doctor or some other type of practice, because this is their one-stop shop. That's what they marketed as, their Panorama campus. Their lease gives them exclusive control of 25 parking spaces and the premises inside the building. And then there's a sidewalk connecting those two. There's non-exclusive possession of the rest of the campus. But if they were on campus, they wouldn't be a trespasser as would somebody else who was trespassing, because they have non-exclusive possession. They still can be on the sidewalk. During the course of the time that they were there, before and after this incident, they dominated the campus with their incessant and numerous thousands of emails and requests for snow removal, for to fix things around the property, to just constantly overwhelming the property manager, the former property manager. They asked to have them removed because they weren't happy with them. That property manager then asked them to quit having the 8 management level employees who were contacting them constantly slim down to one point of contact, because they were just overwhelmed. They asked for chemicals to be able to put down on the sidewalk to be able to remediate conditions on their own. And about a year before this happened, on July 2007, somebody fell on the sidewalk. They had an incident report. They never reported that to their landowner or the landlord. So they took upon themselves the duty. But also the way this whole campus was set up, I mean, if they're not a landowner, then what tenant could be? You know, they had a desk inside the front door, watching out over this sidewalk to the parking spaces where Barbara Jordan's cousin was waiting when she walked out the door and fell down on the uneven sidewalk. That sidewalk, the crack, was a violation of the ADA. The trial court found that violation could itself have been possibly an emergent condition. The trial court's ruling in this case showed that the trial court really looked at all the facts and circumstances, heard the evidence, weighed the credibility of the witnesses, The trial court in her ruling says seven or eight times she mentions the facts. She talks about a bunch of different facts, and she makes the comment that that this was a different tenant than she ever experienced in a normal tenant setting, because they so dominated the games.
Council, can I just ask you just back to the sidewalk? You suggest that there was an unevenness in the sidewalk. Could Panorama fix that themselves?
They had the right to emergency fixing of it. But they also, again, they had not reported it. They knew of somebody tripping on the sidewalk.
But could they go out there and actually lay the concrete themselves?
Themselves, you mean the people in there, or hire somebody to do it, or?
Yeah, or themselves. I mean, I guess I'm trying to figure out, you suggest that they dominate the campus, but I'm trying to narrow in on the sidewalk and what they could actually do, what kind of control they have to fix the problem potentially on the sidewalk that you have complained about.
They could go out and fix it on an emergency situation.
Yeah, and help me understand that.
Well, it's not defined what an emergency is in the contract, so that's, you know, it depends on what that is. But if there's an ADA violation, that could potentially be an emergency. That's what the trial court had found. And, you know, they could, I guess, you know, that might be why they asked for chemicals to be able to put on the sidewalks. They weren't happy with the maintenance company's responses to their requests to come out, but they demanded that they be there at 6 a.m. They weren't always there. They emailed about that. They emailed about their concerns about liability on the property.
So I guess, though, in answer to my question, is they didn't have the ability to fix it in a non-emergency situation?
No. If they had, they wouldn't. It wasn't in the lease. So, I mean, you know, if nobody responded, nobody fixed it, I guess, you know, they could have. I mean, you know, I don't know what that would have done in their relationship with the landlord, but certainly, you know, this isn't just a typical tenant. I mean, these aren't eyeglasses at all. I mean, eyeglasses people might be kind of like an orthopedic surgeon, but it's not like a camera shop or a flower shop. The people coming in and out of here are infirm people. They're using walkers, canes, crutches, and they're their patients. And this is a medical practice whose patients are using this unsafe sidewalk. So, I mean, they're not, their possession, even if it's not an exclusive possession of the sidewalk, they're in possession of the sidewalk. And the Premises Liability Act and this court's precedent made clear that, you know, it's not just one single landowner for a piece of property, but you know, as many as exist under the definition in the
Can I pick up on that thought right there? Because I'm curious as to, there are multiple tenants on this site. Panorama appears to have been the largest. But in your view, could someone have sued another tenant for the same unevenness in the sidewalk under a landowner theory? In other words, is the rule that you're proposing mean that any commercial tenant would qualify as a landowner, or only some kinds of tenants, and if so, how do you define that type of tenant that would qualify?
Well, first let me answer, no, I don't think it could be any tenant, and I don't know that it could be any of the tenants here. I think all facts and circumstances of the case have to be weighed, like this court said in Pearson and said again in LaRue last year. And, you know, we don't have the lease from the other tenants, but we could probably assume that it's similar, because it's hard to believe that they would have, you know, radically different lease. But we don't have that. We know that these parking spaces are, you know, connected by this sidewalk, and the entrance to the other property, and I don't have a site to the record, they talk about that, to the other three tenants, their entrance is kind of to the left and around of those. If you're facing the building, the main portico is the entrance just to Panorama. That's their floor. And then the bottom floor, the entrance is kind of around to the side. And there's another parking area over there. So it's hard to believe that you know, infirm patients that were going, you know, to the bottom would not park at the handicap parking over on that side instead of up near the door, you know, to go all the way around. But I guess they could use that. But those are some of the facts, you know, that distinguish this, you know, this tenant from the other. The other is, I mean, this is their campus. They set this thing up. And they set up, and they're the ones that are sending thousands of emails requesting and demanding that things be fixed and that you know, snow removal will be done by a certain time. There's one point in the testimony where they said they actually removed snow on their own ones. We don't know whether the other tenants did that. And you know, so part of the definition is, it's not just activities, there's a circumstances part of the definition. And you know, the circumstances on the property, that's more than just the physical circumstances on the property. And LaRue clarified Pearson, where you know, litigants and the Tenth Circuit had been viewing language in Pearson to mean that it had to be inherently related to the land, you know, so that it had something physical, a physical activity on the land or a physical circumstance on the land. And LaRue said, no, that's not what we meant. Under the circumstances there, you know, that's what that language dealt with. But it's the circumstances on the land in a broader sense. So here, all of their domination of this campus, I mean, the other tenants didn't dominate the campus as far as I know, like Panorama did. And you know, that created the circumstances that encompassed when Ms. Jordan fell. And so then she fell while they were a landlord.
Mr. Boyle, can I follow up on that? Just as Marcus has done. What rule is it that you want us to write? A tenant is a landowner if they dominate the campus? I mean, what would the rule be that we would write? Because I think what Justice Marcus is getting at is, you know, we got a lot of strip malls in Colorado, and if someone trips going into the, you know, the hardware store, but there's a big grocery store connected, that, you know, to sue them because they got deeper pockets. I mean, what would be the rule that we would write?
Justice Boatwright, to answer your question, I guess what I'd say is, first, uphold Pearson, which is which calls for a fact-by-fact, case-by-case, totality of the circumstances, consideration of what's happening. What the Court of Appeals did below was, you know, a piecemeal, they took one fact and another fact, and that's what Panorama has done in their brief, where they take one fact and say, well, that doesn't make a landowner. And they take another fact and say, well, that doesn't make a landowner. Well, there's a lease clause, well, that doesn't make a landowner. And then that's a piecemeal looking at it and looking for a bright line test. And this court has rejected bright line tests looking at this statute. And we're not asking for the court to expand the law. We're asking for the court to apply Pearson here and follow Pearson and LaRue and say, you know, under the totality of the facts here, this is a landowner.
What are we looking at the totality to decide? What are we trying to find from this totality?
Well, you know, first, I guess we can look at provisions in the lease, you know, we can say, you know, that there's the ability to do emergency repairs. They have an indemnity clause. They've assumed the risk.
Let me just interrupt so I can clarify my question a little. I guess I see all the very many things you're pointing to, but what is it in the definition of a landowner that determines whether that mulligan stew of factors should come out meaning a landowner or not? I mean, and to some extent, when you've been talking about these, we seem to be moving more in the direction of deciding whether Panorama was negligent or whether they had a capacity to correct something. But are those the factors? Are those the things that how a landowner is defined in the statute?
Well, under the statute, it doesn't make clear whether or not it's a question of fact or a question of law. In the trial court, they stipulated to it being a question of law. I would posit that it's so factual that you have to, when you're looking at all the facts, it's you can't just make a bright line test where how many facts, you know, come over the line. But for this case, I mean, I can point to the facts that I think, you know, make a landowner in this case.
Well, counsel, maybe can I just interrupt you, because before, when you were responding to me, I think you said that you don't want to recognize or you don't advocate a traditional possession and control test. You said that, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So that would be one test that these factors might be going to, would be possession and control. So they possessed the sidewalk because they dominated the campus, or whatever fact that you're relying on. But I'm wondering, so if you don't advocate a traditional possession and control, what test do you advocate?
I guess what I'd say is I wouldn't say that you couldn't find that they had possession and control, but I wouldn't say that every tenant, if they have some sort of a non-exclusive access to the property, necessarily comes under the act. But the lease says they have non-exclusive possession. So you could, I guess, say if the court wanted to draw a broad rule, the court could go there. But then we get to the concerns about strip mall owners, with the other side of the sidewalk, the hot dog vendor at Home Depot. They may have the little area right around the hot dog part, but you're not going to. I mean, it'd be hard to read the premises liability act to include, the far corner of the parking lot for them. But I guess the part of it, would be the control part. Here this dominant tenant does control the campus. I mean, they demanded a new property manager, and they got a new property. They demand stuff to be done, and it gets done. They set up the campus to include certain types of tenants. If one moves out, there's not going to be a different type of tenant moving, and it's going to be a different physical therapist or imaging center. So, in a sense, I mean, it's a question whether the absentee landlord is the sole landowner, or whether tenants can be a landowner. And Pearson, this court ruled that tenants can be landowners.
Okay, you're saying that they're in possession because of the lease, and then you're looking at activities, and the activities are people coming into the clinic or the service, right? Is that it? Is that all you're requiring to qualify and then as a landowner that has liability under this statute?
Well, I think I'm
who's responsible for the sidewalk?
I'm sorry?
Who's responsible for the condition of the sidewalk?
I think that at the end of the day here, Panorama becomes responsible. Okay. They can assume the duty to it because they're the only people watching. The landlord becomes, and over time, it does, they have somebody that comes by once a week, but they testify they don't inspect the condition of the sidewalk.
Well, it was an uneven break in the sidewalk, right? The landowner is responsible for that, right? You're not saying, you're saying in addition, the tenant is responsible.
Yeah. And I'm saying that because and we cited the Wheatridge Lumber case, which the Court of Appeals had adopted the restatement of torts section 324A, which it deals with when someone undertakes to do something for it undertakes a duty that and then a third party can rely upon that undertaking because the landlord is becoming reliant on this tenant to report all the problems.
But who does the reliance in that case though? I'm sorry, the landlord is relying on the tenant to keep up the sidewalk?
Here?
Is that what you were just arguing with regard to the restatement? That the landlord had become reliant on the tenant?
I believe so. The landlord, I mean, over the course of the conduct, before and after this incident, but the landlord, is reliant upon the tenant because the tenant is constantly reporting, is constantly complaining about it, and they know that somebody fell out there. So, I mean, not that the landlord knew, but this is a tenant who knows that something happened and didn't report it. And that seems to me like it forms the reliance that
but doesn't your client have to rely to bring a negligent undertaking claim? That's why I'm asking. Doesn't your client have to lie?
I'm sorry.
Doesn't your client have to be the one that's suing the relying on the negligent undertaking, not the landlord?
Well, under Weaver's Lumber, I guess if I describe the facts, are you familiar with it?
Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
So, I mean, it would be our client relying on somebody to do it. And, you know, because they go on the property expected to be safe, they're coming along, and, I mean, and other people.
Well, sure, the landlord. Sue the landlord.
Well, but...
They're responsible for the sale.
But the landlord then, you know, is relying on someone else to report it. And so, then, and if I...
That the uneven relying on... the landlord doesn't have to do inspection of the sidewalk until the tenant notifies? Is that what you're arguing?
Well, I'm arguing that the landlord has some responsibility. The jury here, of course, in the landlord, 60% responsible, the property manager 10%, and Panorama 30% after hearing all the facts. Now, of course, that's after the duty question that we're looking at today, but, you know, that's another fact finder that listened to all these facts and said, you know, well, they're not 100% responsible, they're partially responsible, because of all the facts that we've heard, you know, we're going to find that there's this much responsible. The jury's finding was that they were, you know, that they had found that they knew or would have gone up the incident, or up the dangerous condition, and failed to do anything about it because it was an invitee. You know, but I'd like to talk about a few of the other things that a few of the other facts. I mean, here there's a under the lease, there's an assumption of the risk clause. There's a that they assume it for in upon and about the premises. Now, later on in that same, it's under the title indemnification, in that same paragraph, they're required to report injuries that occur in the premises. So they in that same paragraph, they're using in upon about, and then the next sentence, or the sentence after that, they're using in the premises. So there's a reading of that looks like they mean something different in a pause about. And about the premises, I mean, here you're looking at exclusive possession of some parking spaces, then a sidewalk in between, which is kind of like an island, and then you've got this property that, you know, right inside the door from there on in there, you know, that's their entryway. And so, you know, about the premises would be that sidewalk. They had pro rata responsibility for paying for repairs and maintenance. In Constable, and I don't know all the facts in Constable, to be, you know, there were some comments about, you know, some of the lease provisions, including the indemnity clause and you know, the pro rata responsibility, that it looked like they had some liability or potential liability, some duty to their invitees, and that raises another question. I mean, this is an invitee, at least at this time. I think she'd gone to some of the other clinics in the building because it's a one-stop shop. At this time, they're an invitee for this tenant. So, I mean, it wouldn't be like a strip mall where, you know, somebody falls on the sidewalk, they sue like every single one of the tenants. I mean, even if it was, you know, it would be the invitee for that tenant if the court meant it. But really, this is about, you know, upholding and following this court's prior precedent. And it's not about expanding, you know. So
you're saying that they assume this is the very threshold of their place of business.
This is the threshold of?
This is the threshold of their place of business, the place, the yeah. Part of the sidewalk right in front.
Yes.
So Springer was tripping over a piece of the doorway that extended, and they tripped over it. So you're trying to narrow this based upon assumptions of the relationship of the lease and the fact that the circumstances, these facts are narrow, having to do with the entryway, in effect, in possession and control of this tenant.
Yes, Justice Hoff, this sidewalk, it's not right outside. I mean, it's several feet outside the door, but not before the end of the building. If you look at the exhibit one or two, there's some pictures of the building. You can see the building in the corner of the building there. I mean, it's before the corner of that building. And so, you know, it's pretty much just outside, you know, 10, 15 feet outside the door, but it's on the way to these spots that are their spots. And I think I'd like to reserve the rest of the time.
We certainly do so. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. Alan Epstein representing Panorama Orthopedics and Spine Center. Under the Fifth Premises Liability Act, a landowner is a person in possession of real property, a person responsible for the condition of real property or for the activities conducted or circumstances existing on real property. Thus, the undisputed evidence in the record in this case established that Panorama did not possess the common area sidewalk in the office complex on which plaintiff tripped, nor was it responsible for the condition of the sidewalk. The Court of Appeals correctly determined that Panorama was not a landowner as a matter of law. Counsel started off with the proposition that if Panorama is not a landowner, then who is? I would counter that with the argument that if Panorama is a landowner, then who isn't? What commercial tenant would not be? Plaintiff relies on certain lease provisions and facts concerning Panorama's tenancy to support its argument that the totality of the circumstances supported the trial court's conclusion that Panorama was a landowner. Plaintiff argues that viewing these facts and these provisions in isolation may not confer landowner status, but that considered as a totality, they do. But the sum total of any number of zeros never equals one. And if Panorama is a landowner in this case, then virtually every commercial tenant in Colorado will be, because plaintiff's totality of the circumstances theory of liability will always allow the sum total of any number of zeros to equal one. Despite plaintiff's protest to the contrary, there is no principled means of containing that theory of liability.
Could I ask you a question there, Mr. Epstein? Is there some reason why we should think that the statute did not intend landowner to be very broad and include very many people?
It does. It is very broad. It does include very many people, but those people have to meet the criteria of what the land of what a landowner is. And Panorama was not a landowner in this case because it was not possessing that sidewalk. The owner did, and the property manager did.
Let me ask you a question. This was definitely true in Larry U, but it seems true here too. We have this strange situation, sort of juxtaposition of interests, in which you're arguing that your client is not a landowner. But that only makes sense for you because the question of negligence is already off the table. Basically, the PLA protects landowners, does it not, from and narrows their liability. And so normally one would think a landowner would be people would be clamoring to make themselves landowners and have the PLA protect them. But it's only because of this dance we do with negligence and PLA and one being off the table that now, having won the first argument, it makes sense for you to argue that the landowner definition is narrow. Does that not seem strange to you?
No. A person is only protected under the Act if he is indeed a landowner because of the sliding scale of standard of care with respect to the status of the plaintiff as a tenant, invitee, or licensee. If that person is not a landowner, then the Act affords him no protection because it imposes liability where there otherwise would be none. If there were no Act and
where does it impose liability where there would be none?
Because if the person is not a landowner, as Panorama was not a landowner, then the cause of action the plaintiff would have, had there been no act, would be negligence. And plaintiff's argument that the negligence claim was dismissed, and that's how Panorama was protected, is circular reasoning. Because if plaintiff had sued Panorama for negligence, common law negligence, then under the circumstances of this case, Panorama would have owed no legal duty, which is tantamount to saying it wasn't a landowner in this case, because the parties
that did owe plaintiff a legal duty under the lease and under the circumstances of this case were the property owner and the property manager. And there were two landowners in this case, the property owner and the property manager with whom plaintiff settled and from whom plaintiff...
Does that suggest that no one but a landowner could be negligent and liable?
Yeah, no, I'm not suggesting that someone else could be negligent. But when you're talking about a condition on real property, then under the statute, the defendant must, in order to be a landowner, possess the property and Panorama didn't, or create the condition on the property, which Panorama didn't.
You see, yeah, I'm not following that exactly. To follow up Justice Carson, he's fully capable of doing this, but let me get in here because it's a standard of care, and if the facts are that they didn't warn about a hazard, the hazard existed, and this person got injured as a result of that, coming to this person's business, why isn't that a theory of negligence, a breach of the standard of care owed?
Because the duty was owed by the property.
The facts were that your clients were aware of this condition, right? They failed to correct it, or failed to notify, or failed to warn the persons coming into the place of business. Why isn't that a theory of negligence that's colorable under our common law negligence, duty of care? That's my question.
Because the duty of care was owed in this case exclusively by the property owner and the property manager.
But you're relying on the Premises Liability Act for that conclusion, aren't you? Isn't Justice Coates pointing out another quandary here with respect to our sorting through the common law and the statutory design that describes the liability of landowners?
It is, but I think that's conflating the concept of duty with negligence. Where there is no negligence, where there is no duty, there can be no negligence. And in every case, by analogy, in which this court reversed a jury decision that a defendant was negligent because it owed no duty, the jury had already determined that that defendant was negligent. In this case, the analogous analysis is that one has to be a landowner in order to owe the duty to fix it. And in this case, there wasn't. The undisputed testimony in this case was that Panorama did not and could not fix the sidewalk. That had to be done by the property owner, who testified that Panorama, in trial, Panorama had no right to do anything with the sidewalk, only we did.
Counsel, if I might just tack on to that a little bit, and I'm just trying to understand the difference, and I think this might be where Justice Hobbs was going. You seem to be saying that the plaintiff's theory of negligence had to do with this condition of the property, and in that sense, if the duty owes a duty to repair this condition that caused the accident, that type of duty comes under the PLA. And I think where Justice Hobbs may have been going was, what if we're talking about a different duty, the duty of Panorama to notify the landlord that this condition exists? Is that sort of an independent theory of negligence that's outside the PLA for which Panorama could be held liable? In other words, is there a way, if the PLA doesn't work against Panorama for all the reasons you've argued, is there not, does the plaintiff not have at least some other route to pursue negligence?
Pursue common law negligence?
Right.
Well, I don't think the record supports the proposition that Panorama knew that there was a...
Fair enough. I'm just sort of speaking hypothetically here, in part just to sort of disentangle what is sort of, in other words, the quandary that Justice Coates pointed out, where we have a series of cases coming up where the defendant is sued both for negligence and the PLA. They get negligence off the table and then argue that they're not a landowner under the PLA. I'm just wondering if there are other routes for plaintiffs to pursue negligence theories, even if they're not based on, you know, the condition of property.
I can conceive of factual scenarios where there would be.
If there was a series of incidents in which patients were tripping on the sidewalk and it was an obvious danger and it kept happening and Panorama did not inform the property owner, then maybe under those circumstances there could be joint liability as landowners, or Panorama might be independently negligent or something that was.
Well, what if Panorama put one of its patients in a wheelchair? The nurse took the wheelchair out to the parking lot, slipped on the ice, and let the wheelchair go. They could be sued for that. That's pretty pure negligence, right?
Then we'd have a different case.
Then we would have a PLA case then. But the point here is that this was phrased as a PLA case, right? A phrase it was pled as a PLA case, premises liability case.
Yes.
And you were sued under that. Your client was sued under PLA. And you said
and negligence.
Sure. And you said no. We can't be because we don't fit into that category. And in addition, we can't be negligent because we don't have any duty because the PLA takes that away from us. Right?
This court's holding in Vigil and Pearson says that for accidents occurring on real property, the PLA is the exclusive remedy against the landowner.
Yeah.
So
you
it's
just
all consistent.
That.
Sorry?
So I'm saying, so it's all consistent under the statutory makeup of the premise liability case. And we're looking for scenarios in which there might be some negligence, but those would be unusual, like my example.
There could be. That scenario doesn't present itself in this case because the negligence claim was dismissed and not appealed by plaintiff. So as a procedural matter, that doesn't obviate Panorama's non-liability under the statute.
Well, that's important, is it not? This is some tricky business. I mean, regarding how broad a holding would be that you're suggesting. So what should we hold?
I'm sorry.
What should we hold? Because it sounded like your argument in your briefing has to do with the fact that, you know, you're tucked in onto the land and you're protected against all scenarios having to do with the circumstances of the settlement. And surely, you know, what you just said about the procedural posture, the negligence claim was dismissed and not appealed, would suggest that we write a very narrow opinion, not a precedent, a negligence claim that is preserved. That's all I'm trying to get at here.
It would be this, the opinion in this case wouldn't necessarily be that narrow because the negligence claim was not preserved. And I don't think under the circumstances of this case, the negligence claim stated a cause of action because the theory was not that Panorama didn't warn the landlord of the deviation in the sidewalk. The theory was that Panorama owed a duty to fix it. And the undisputed lease provisions and factual testimony was that it did not. There may be other cases in which you've got a different factual scenario where there could be coexisting PLA and negligence claims, but not in this case.
Mr. Epstein, good morning. Can I back up a little bit? Was the negligence claim dismissed at halftime, or was it dismissed for failure to state a claim in the 12b-5?
It was either 12b-5 or summary judgment.
Okay, but that was my question because you said it was dismissed for failure to state a claim because there was no duty to fix it, and those are really two different.
No, it was dismissed or disposed of on summary judgment on the basis that the PLA was the exclusive remedy.
That sounds like a problem to me.
That's why I'm asking the question. So the court determined that the exclusive remedy was because Panorama was a landowner then? Is that why the truck was, that's what I'm asking.
The ruling by the trial court was that a PLA is the exclusive remedy. The trial court also would not dismiss the premises liability claim based upon the reasoning that whether Panorama was a landowner was a question of fact for the jury to determine. Then at halftime, the trial court determined, no, it's not a question of fact. I'm ruling that that Panorama was a landowner as a matter of law.
Right.
That's the procedural history, as I recall.
All right, thank you.
Counsel, could I get you to directly address your opposing counsel's argument, which is basically, as I understand it, there are a number of lease provisions that show that you did not have legal control over the sidewalk. Right, you didn't have responsibility over it. But in this case, the facts essentially overrode those lease provisions in the sense that, as a functioning matter, Panorama exerted control over this sidewalk. They complained that it wasn't properly shoveled, and I mean, essentially, that there are facts separate and apart from the legal provisions in the lease that would make
that an
error. Can I get you to
respond to that? Yes. Panorama did not direct the property owner or property manager to do anything. Panorama requested that the property owner remove snow from the parking lot because it was behaving as a responsible tenant on behalf of its patients. Like any other responsible tenant, It was complaining when there was the necessity for maintenance. Some of the other maintenance requests to which plaintiff refers are, we need light bulbs, we need toilet paper. But there was no direction. That's a misstatement of the record. For example.
Well, and before you give me examples, would that have made a difference? Okay. I'm just trying to figure out, what do you do with the evidence? I'll just, of maintenance requests, however you frame that, what does that evidence go to?
Absolutely nothing. When the elevator doesn't work in my building, we'll call maintenance to make sure that it's working. We're a tenant, we're not a landowner. We can't do it ourselves. In fact, it is demonstrative of just the opposite. If Panorama was a landowner, it would be undertaking those maintenance responsibilities, not requesting that the landowner do it. Every tenant in an office building does that. When there's a necessity for snow removal or any other kind of maintenance, that just shows that Panorama was being a responsible tenant. And it wasn't directing anything. For example, and this quote is at page 2142 of the record. This is some of the testimony the plaintiff relies on to argue that Panorama was directing the property owner to do things. Question, and Panorama was insisting that parking lot get cleared by 6 a.m., correct? Answer, I guess I could insist, but it wouldn't do me any good. I could only request. I could say please, I could say we are really asking, but I couldn't tell them to do, or I guess they would try, but it was their decision. And as the Court of Appeals reason in the amicus brief in this case explains, as a matter of public policy, imposing landowner liability or status on a commercial tenant for requesting safety maintenance would have the anomalous effect of creating a disincentive for responsible conduct. And similarly, plaintiff argues that Panorama's creation of incident reports makes it a landowner. Imposing landowner status would also have the anomalous effect of discouraging the creation of incident reports. With respect to some of the other arguments plaintiff advances in this case, the plaintiff relies on the lease provisions indemnity clause, and plaintiff argues that because the lease provides the Panorama to indemnify the owner for injuries occurring on Panorama's premises, that Panorama is a landowner, and plaintiff argued here that the phrase on, upon, or about the premises includes the common area sidewalk. but the lease identifies separately the premises, which is the building Panorama occupied, and the common areas, which specifically included the sidewalk. So under basic principles of statutory construction, the indemnity provision does not apply to the sidewalk. The phrase on, upon, or about is arcane legalese, and plaintiff has not found any case in which the word about was construed to mean outside of. But in any event, even if the indemnity provision applied to injuries occurring on the common area sidewalk, no case is held that an indemnity provision between a tenant indemnitor and a landlord indemnitee gives rise to an indemnitor's duty to a third party of the contract, or as in this case, creates landowner status. Plaintiff emphasizes that Panorama was a dominant tenant in the office complex, and that the other businesses in this complex were medically related and may have provided services to Panorama's patients. So it doesn't matter whether a tenant's small, dominant, or the only tenant. What matters under the Act is whether the tenant possessed the property, controlled it, or conducted an activity which caused the plaintiff's injuries, and Panorama did none of those things. Plaintiff argues that Panorama employees refer to the complex as ours. That's a common colloquialism. When people ask me, what building do I work in, I say, that's my building. It doesn't mean that the firm I work for, Hall & Evans, owns the building. I would guess that Your Honor sometimes may refer to this building as ours, even though the Court of Appeals is also here. And the fact that it was the Panorama Medical Campus, called the Panorama Medical Campus, many buildings downtown have signage that identify one or more, but not all, of the tenants in the building. Does that mean that the tenants that are identified as signage are landowners, but the ones who aren't identified are not landowners? Plaintiff argues that there was a receptionist desk at the front door, and the receptionist could look out the window and see the common areas. Well, most law firms aren't wanting to have a receptionist at the front door. Does that mean that they're landowners? And with respect to the argument that there were reserved parking spaces, lots of businesses have reserved parking spaces. Lots of businesses and stores have reserved parking spaces. That doesn't mean that they are possessing, controlling, or creating a condition on the sidewalk that is adjacent to the parking spaces. And the fact that a patient or customer has to use a sidewalk to get into the tenant's office or store is common to all businesses or stores located in building complexes. And refer to the analogy of a strip mall or any kind of mall. In a big mall, Nordstrom will have a door that you can walk into, but you have to walk into the building down the hall to get to the Sunglass Hut. Does that mean that Nordstrom is a landowner and Sunglass Hut is not? And again, plaintiff argued, and Your Honors pointed out, that there can be more than one landowner under the expansive reading of the Act. And
well, let's suppose something happened inside your space, inside your law firm, inside your lease premises, okay? What happens then? Let's suppose there's some condition in there that was built like that, but it's inside your space and somebody trips over it and suffers damages. Who's responsible for that? Only the landowner? Or is the tenant also responsible? And what is the correct legal theory for that cause of action?
If it was in...
It's at the threshold or inside the space that you lease. And there's some condition that causes injury to the clients. Who's responsible?
I can conceive of a situation in which if there was a object that was tripped over, and we should have been aware of it because we put it there.
No, that wasn't my question. It's there and you know about it and you allow it to exist, and your clients trip over it and cause injury. Now, is that the problem of the landowner, or is that the problem of your firm, or is it a joint problem on different theories?
I presume that there could be that could be a situation in which the firm would be considered a landowner because it is our premises. But
based on
the sidewalk was not Panorama's premises.
Okay.
Mr. Epstein, the same constellation of facts that give rise to the dominant tenant theory as to landowner and a PLA, am I correct in assuming that that's what was argued in the 12b-5 or the summary judgment motion and evaluating whether or not there was a duty and common law negligence? I mean, what I sort of hear you say, I think, is that the arguments that they're advancing, if they have merit at all, are better suited to evaluation of whether the law should recognize a duty and negligence and not whether it establishes landowner status under the PLA. Am I making sense?
Well, in this case, the motion for either motion to dismiss or motion for summary judgment subsumed all of those theories. It wasn't a premises, it was a premises liability case, and therefore it happened on real property, therefore it was a premises liability case. And the argument, the defendant's argument was that because it's a premises liability case, the negligence claim can't survive.
So it never got to the point that I'm describing. Right?
No.
There was, all right.
Plaintiff argues that there can be more than one landowner. Yes, there can. Plaintiff refers to, says that the landowner should not be considered the passive absentee landlord. Passive absentee landlord. And yes, there can be more than one landowner. In fact, in this case, there were two landowners, the property owner and the property manager. And the property owner, in this case, was the passive absentee landlord to whom plaintiff was referring and from whom plaintiff received compensation. And in the context of commercial buildings, characterizing the owner as an absentee landlord would make virtually all commercial tenants, at least in downtown buildings, landowner, since the property owner typically is not located in the building. I know the property owner of the building I work in isn't located there. And plaintiff argues that the Court of Appeals replaced the trial court's findings of fact. It did not. The Court of Appeals relied on undisputed operative facts in the record to reach a different but correct legal conclusion that Panorama was not a landowner. Finally, plaintiff argues that the Court of Appeals injected causation into the analysis of whether Panorama was a landowner. What the Court of Appeals did was to follow this court's Pearson v. Black Canyon Aggregates decision, in which the court held that a landowner is someone who, quote, is responsible for the activity or condition and therefore prospectively liable to an entrant onto the property. Common definition of responsible is answerable, accountable, liable to be called into account, having authority or control, being the cause. That's at 49 Pacific 3rd at 1221. Of course, causation is just an element in the analysis. If the defendant did not do something to cause plaintiff's injuries, then the plaintiff wouldn't have a cause of action. Unless there are further questions, Panorama requests that this court affirm the Court of Appeals.
So what's an example of the causal connection that might occur? Is it Chief Justice Rice's wheelchair example? Presumably not. What permutation can you imagine where there would be the causal connection that you're talking about that Judge Jones mentions at the end of the opinion?
Well, the causation analysis that I'm plaintiff arguing that the Court of Appeals improperly injected causation into the determination of whether the defendant was a landowner. And my only point is that causation, if there's no causation, there's no cause of action. And that this court was recognizing that concept in that quote that I just stated from Pearson, it isn't a consideration of whether the defendant is a landowner, but absent causation, there can't be a cause of action. I think that's all Pearson was saying.
You think that's all that Judge Jones was saying at the end of the opinion?
Yes, I think that's. I do think that's what Judge was saying at the end of the opinion.
Okay.
Thank you. In response to the last question, I believe LaRue addressed that issue. It's not causation of that's tied to the circumstance of the action, or it does not have to be inherently tied to the land. It's not. Sure, there has to be some prospective causation, like there does in any duty question. And there has to be some way to say that if there was an incident there after there's a duty, the person could be liable. But that's part of any duty question. I mean, it's kind of like I think LaRue kind of rejected that argument. Here. There was some talk about the negligence claim and what it claimed. And at page 24 of the record, well, 23 too, is kind of that's what the facts are. But in the amended complaint, and page 24 says the negligence claim, and it's a negligence claim against all defendants. And you know, it's the standard type of negligence claim. I'm not going to read through all the paragraphs, but the you know they say that there was a duty to protect the patients, that there was a dangerous condition, that they didn't protect them from it, and that the person tripped on it. You know, I think that it could have stood if it hadn't been rejected. And the trial court's ruling, you know, saying that the PLA was the only way that they could proceed at summary judgment appears to be kind of like a LaRue ruling, in the sense that, you know, the defense was arguing that the only way to proceed in an injury on the land is through the premises liability. An injury on the land of another is through the premises liability. That just isn't true. I mean, if somebody's on Panorama's land and is injured on Panorama's land, then they proceed to the premises liability. If it's not Panorama's land, then they proceed in negligence. If it's Panorama's fault, they would have a duty there.
Well, let me follow. So maybe you can answer the question I asked Mr. Epstein. This was dismissed in a summary judgment, and did Panorama argue that the only remedy was premises liability? Do you know, was it summary judgment or 12b-5?
At summary judgment, the Panorama argued that there was no liability. And then they argued in each separate. They said there was no liability in negligence or in the premises liability act.
And why did they say there was a duty under negligence? What was their theory behind that?
I don't recall what their argument was in the summary judgment.
Well, I'm trying to figure out if they're going to argue that on both sides is what I'm trying to figure out.
Well. I think that really what they were doing was trying to argue that there was neither, but the argument for the premises liability act was that you know it was an injury on the land of another, and so that would be the only you know way that you'd have a claim, but it wasn't on their land, so you wouldn't have a claim here either. The court kind of jumped on the first part of the argument that you can only proceed for an injury on the land of another through the premises liability act, and so there couldn't be a negligence claim. And then you know they go along, but then they benefit from that. They get the protection of the premises liability act instead of facing a court action. And of course it's invitee, so it's basically the same thing. But you know if it was a different type of entrant, they would have greater protection under the act.
Now, what clause are we in? Do you think you have like negligence action that survived all this, or did you waive it?
I'm sorry?
Did you waive the negligence action or did it survive? Was it preserved?
It wasn't preserved. There was no cross appeal on it and it wasn't raised in the briefing and the court rulings.
And I get go ahead.
So
my concern is, isn't I mean, you are making an argument that this just isn't, quote, fair. But didn't the legislature basically take those kinds of decisions away from us when it decided that we weren't going to proceed with common law negligence, that rather we were going to have a premises liability act and deal with certain kinds of injuries exclusively under that act?
Well, Chief Justice Rice, the act is exclusive to landowners. So when somebody's not a landowner, it's not exclusive. We believe Panorama is a landowner.
It's exclusive to injuries which occur on real property, on land.
Yes.
Premises.
But
therefore, if something occurs on the premises, we try to determine why the person is on the premises. Right? Under the statutory scheme.
That's correct.
And what the statute is saying is we're going, I mean, the legislature, the Supreme Court has kind of been back and forth on this issue, if you look at the history of it. And they spoke last. They've set up the Premises Liability Act. Well, what it seems, and maybe I'm incorrect, but what I'm hearing from you is you're saying, I just don't like that. I don't like the way the Premises Liability Act is set up. But that's not really ours to decide anymore at this point, is it? The legislature has spoken.
Thank you, Chief Justice Rice. I believe you're correct, but the way that the act is set up, it states that that it only applies to landowners. So, if somebody else is injured on real property, I mean, all injuries have to happen on real property, it's either public real property or not, but it's real property. I mean, it would seem absurd to me that the statute is meant to subsume all negligence. A car crash happens on real property, just between two people on the street, but the only defendant isn't the person that owns the street.
I see your time is up soon, and she wanted to finish up my your answer to my question. Do you have anything more to say with respect to that?
We would ask the court to reverse and restore the judgment. And thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Mr. Boyle, we appreciate your argument, and Mr. Epstein, we appreciate your argument as well. The court will be in recess until 1:30 after this. Thank you.